Good morning, planet Earth. Good morning to the creatures that crawl within the Earth. The worms and insects, the microbes that break down organic matter and give us that good old-fashioned topsoil to grow our beets and onions in. Good morning. Good morning to farmers' markets selling baked bread. Good morning to vineyards pressing the wine. Good morning to the pubs, to the bear cubs, to my lost lub someplace in Splunkton. Good morning. Clean out your closet. Find your boxes. It is January the 31st, the last day of January, 2025, Bo Blimpdoc. It's 2:40 a.m. on the Olympic Peninsula, not far from where those ghosts wander about, near that place where something happened. And it's why we remember old Mr. Scrivington on St. Blubbin's Day. We don't talk about what he did to those people. We don't talk about where they went. We don't talk about the hole or the bones. We just remember, you know, our founding father. So it's Friday, thank God, right? And I'm mainly glad because I got paid today. I don't know. If you knew how little I made, or how much, depending upon your perspective, I don't know, you might feel pity or disgust. I seriously doubt you'll ever feel envy, but that's a thing. But I get paid, and by the end of the day, 75% of it's already, you know, gone. You know, living expenses, food, water, shelter, all the basics, gone. And, you know, there's also a simple truth that I have not been the best at making the wisest financial decisions in recent years, but I've also not had that much to wager. And so, in a sense, if I've made poor decisions, the outcomes have been directed at myself, and they really don't add up to much. Even if you put them into a pile, they don't add up to much. But it is Friday and I got paid. I am still in a deadlock condition with respect to a lot of the projects I'm working on. I'm circling the drain. I hope to have a breakthrough this weekend, but then I hope to have a breakthrough over Christmas break, and that didn't happen. And the main reason, well, there's two reasons. One is that I'm not really that well. I'm better than last year, but the winters here are hard on me, and you know, there's other things that interact that we don't want to talk about. We're going to try not to, right? So yeah, I want to get some stuff done this weekend, but it's probably more likely that I will spend both days listening to music, drinking beer, vaping weed, staring bleakly outward into an expanding filthy emptiness. As I escape further inward, deeper into my castle keep, the valley is named Green. There's a dragon at the end. There's a castle made of steel. There's a woman that lives there. She calls me her friend. We'll see. There's really no need to get dramatic. I have 2.5 chapters finished. The third chapter I could probably finish this weekend. That basically means I have about nine-ish chapters to finish. You know, I've already outlined the book. I could finish it by the end of February. I wanted to have it done by February the 2nd. That is extremely unlikely at this point. I mean, in theory, I can crank out 1,000 to 2,000 words an hour. So in theory, I could probably crank it out in a few days, but not by Sunday close of business, not unless I stay up all night and do nothing but type. And the net effect of that would probably be a lot of shit. So rather than push it, I'm going to try to break through on it and then maybe do a little bit of work on the radio project if I can. But I'm burnt out, brothers and sisters. You know, I'm not really getting rich here in Portland, and nor do I think that's a feasible thing. I mean, I know I could take my money and invest in the stock market. I could invest in Bitcoin. I could certainly put together a serious resume instead of the joke one I have floating right now on Indeed. And I could seriously try to get another one of those remote gigs. And if the Potemkin businesses of 2022 are currently as replete, I could get myself one of those Potemkin jobs and just sit here and play pretend and get paid by who knows what. Because I'm convinced at this point, I worked for a company in 2022. I got paid really well. And the problem was that I couldn't, how can I put it? This is a little bit like The Matrix. I had to simply reject it. I couldn't accept it as real. It wasn't real. It was fake. It was very fake. And maybe it was real, but it seemed fake to me. And yeah, so maybe I could get one of those jobs where I'm making $6K or $7K or $8K after taxes every month and thinking I'm rich. But it's just not where I'm at. I can't do it. I can't. I wish I could, but I can't. I can type the code. I can do the project management. I can do all the things that are necessary. I have all the skills and I have enough energy to do it, but I can't. I won't. I don't want to. It's merely an issue of bullshit. At this point, there is no point. If I had a family, if I had kids, okay, whatever. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But in terms of my own life, nah. So anyways, it's Friday. We got to be happy. This next topic is a little bit serious, but it's abstract. And I think it's helpful because sometimes it's important to understand the person you're listening to. And some of my listeners, quote unquote, in recent months who've gone ballistic or insane or have become unhinged, assuming they're real people, that is, they clearly didn't understand where I'm coming from. I mean, when you really think about it, think about this abstractly. Before we get into complicated ethical topics, I want you to put on your metaphysician's helmet and think about this logically. If you know somebody's an anarchist, and if you know they push the limits on freedom of speech and other issues, how many police officers do you think would be the demographic of listeners? And maybe it could be 20 cops listen to me, but I don't think they really listen. Well, no. I think they may hear me. They may not listen. The point is, actual listeners who are real people, how many of them demographically would be police officers? Especially given the small size of the sample set. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, does it? So it doesn't mean I know what's going on, but if you told me one of my listeners was a cop, and this is abstract, I don't know. I don't know what my listeners do for a living. I mean, I've met people who claim to live places, and if I'm there for a couple weeks, they can't meet for coffee. So I don't really know who the fuck people are. I don't. I can make logical guesses about freaks, but I can't tell you if any particular freak is real or not. But it does seem unlikely that a police officer, or frankly, anybody with a security clearance, beyond just being an ordinary cop, would ever be listening to me, ever. It's weird. You need to understand that I am not an end justifies the means person. I don't believe in utilitarianism. I think it's a kind of, it's a trick. It's a con, really. And it cons you into believing something that's not true, that we're like gods, that essentially we can see the future. And they give you situations, like my favorite situation that the quote-unquote consequentialists or utilitarians or the end justifies the means people, the thing they'll give you is something like the trolley problem. Say, Dan, what if I stuck you on a trolley with, I don't know, 30 or 40 people? Up ahead, there's a person on the track. And if you keep going on that track, you're going to kill that person, but you'll save the people on board. If you pull a lever, you'll cause the trolley to skip off the tracks and probably kill 30 people. Blah, blah, blah. And if you want an interesting kind of deeper, and I do think deeper investigation of the trolley problem, assuming you want to give it that much time, there's a movie that came out in 1964 called Failsafe. It is a great film. And it's interesting because there were two movies, I think, that came out that year. Failsafe, and the one that people tend to remember, because frankly it's funnier, and sometimes you need a little bit of funny with your doom, Dr. Strangelove. Both films dealt with the question of accidental nuclear war. It's interesting. One of them dealt from its, you know, it's funny. One was from the perspective of just the whimsical, wouldn't it be great or interesting to live in that post-nuclear apocalypse, whatever. I mean, no, that's not what anybody should believe, but it was a whimsical journey into nuclear war, Dr. Strangelove. Failsafe is kind of a scary film. It is. If you're serious about the issues of nuclear conflict, if you understand the theories around it, I think Kahn, is it Herman Kahn? I think he wrote On Thermonuclear War back in the 50s or 60s for the RAND Corporation. He more or less developed the theories around things like limited nuclear war. And he was one of these folks with von Neumann, with John Nash and others in the field of game theory to deal with these types of questions. What if? What if somebody blew up a city but it wasn't on purpose? How do you de-escalate? The folks, supposedly, under Robert McNamara, the folks who worked for JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis, supposedly, they were influenced by this kind of new way of thinking. Whatever. I mention Failsafe because if you want to explore the trolley problem, Failsafe is a better example. It's a potentially a real-world example. If you believe that China and Russia are independent agents, and I don't know that I believe that. I don't even know if I believe that Iran at this point is an independent agent. I see it more as an orchestra of bullshit. And in that sense, they're all just players. They all just, you know, one's wind section, another one's brass, right? Another one's percussion. But if you see them, Xi and Putin and Trump et al., and frankly, whoever's running France at this point, because they're a nuclear power too, and the UK, they got the bomb, and there's Pakistan and India and a whole bunch of folks, North Korea. And yeah, the state of Israel has nukes, probably has hydrogen bombs. Yeah, that's probably true, but they'll never admit to it. Why? You know, you know, there's that thing, who is John Galt? What I want to say to people these days when it comes to the state of Israel is, you know, what happened to the USS Liberty? Because that'll stop a fucking conversation with an idiot Zionist, won't it? We made a mistake, or we did it on purpose. You know, if the trolley problem is of interest, it's for people that can't see past the simple binaries. And we all get struck by them. I do too. But we should break out of them when we can. I think the trolley problem is basically torture. So before I get too deep into this question of what it means to be a consequentialist, which I am not, or a non-consequentialist, which I am, and frankly, I think Jesus would classify himself as, and Immanuel Kant and a whole bunch of others, before we get into it, I want to just deal with this issue again. I've talked about the trolley problem, as I've talked about things like the Milgram experiment, and there's a general classification for these types of Gedanken or thought experiments or frankly with the Milgram experiment, actual quote-unquote experiments, and that is their Doritos for the brain. If you're simple-minded and you can't see past it, you can't see it for what it is. The trolley problem is a Skinner box. The trolley problem is torture. It doesn't have to be about a trolley. It could be about anything. That's why I said, if you want to see something that will at least tip its hat to any subtlety that might exist in the trolley problem, see Failsafe. But in reality, I kind of think Failsafe points the other direction. I think it points to a world where people think beyond just cause and effect. A non-consequentialist evaluates ethical decisions not based upon what will happen, but based upon whether or not they're right or wrong. Someone like myself wants to understand why you're doing what you're doing beyond just, it's going to make me money, or this is how I get myself retirement, or how do we bring peace in the Middle East unless we blow these people up? If I look at the world post 9/11, that's a consequentialist world constructed by people who are driven and fueled by the belief that they can game their way to total control. And I think that that's false. I don't think that that's a good path. Now, the people that do this, whoever they are, they don't care about right and wrong. So these questions that you ask about the trolley problem, they don't really give a rat's ass. For example, think about the movie Failsafe for a second. Let's say we accidentally nuked a city in Russia. In the movie Failsafe, it's Moscow. But let's say we accidentally nuke St. Petersburg, that was once Leningrad, but before that St. Petersburg. Let's say we accidentally nuked Peter the Great's little town on the Baltic. We could make the deal, the Solomon's bargain of saying an American city should also be nuked. That could happen. But if it did happen, there are two perspectives. One perspective is just survival. Like if you're in that situation and what you want to do is just avoid a war, not because it's ethical, but because you don't want to die of radiation poisoning, then a good move is to say, listen, we accidentally blew up St. Petersburg. You can accidentally blow up, I don't know, Dayton, Ohio, or I don't know, Tacoma. The point is, here's a couple places. We pick a place. You can blow it up. And if you avoid the nuclear war that destroys the world, you could make the argument the end justifies the means. In this particular instance, Tacoma or Boston or El Paso or whatever little town or big city or small city you offer up that's equal to what we destroyed in Russia, you could say, well, we had to run over that dude. If we didn't run over that dude, all the people on the trolley gonna die. But the problem is that this kind of reasoning ends up going both directions. It's not just that it goes towards, oh, we're going to achieve perfect utopia and save everybody. It also points towards hell. And at any moment, you can't really be sure if the guy running the trolley is somebody you can trust or not. And even if they make a decision you think is good, the truth is you don't have any power. And this is another problem with the trolley problem itself. All these people, the guy tied to the track, the people on the trolley, it seems as if their opinions are irrelevant. And the way you get boxed in is you only have a couple seconds. Mr. Man on the switch, you see the trolley coming down the track, you see the person across the track who's tied to the track. You're not on the trolley. You really don't have a lot of skin in the game as far as survival. You just have to decide to pull the lever, to knock the trolley off the tracks to save one life, or not pull the lever and let the trolley run over the person. There you go. But the world probably doesn't work that way. And what is critical, nobody cares in the trolley problem about the opinion of the person tied to the track or the people on the trolley. You might be surprised. What if the trolley were filled with people over the age of 70 and it was a woman on the track and she was pregnant? What if the people on the trolley were saying, pull the lever, save the woman? Then what do you do, Mr. Consequentialist, buddy? Yeah, what do you do? I don't want to spend the whole podcast on this, but if you're trying to understand one of the lenses through which I see the world, and you don't want to get into my anarchism or my Christianity, you can understand that I don't believe any of us are that good at predicting the future. Not really. I mean, I make wild guesses all the time, and I think some of my guesses are pretty good, but they're still just guesses. And the one thing I would never have you do is decide to pull a lever. And let's think about that for a second. There are a lot of people out there in the alt world. Alex Jones is a good example, but there are lots of people out there, big names, small names. And there's something they almost always do. And January 6, 2021 is a great example. That's your trolley problem for today, shithead. It's not just that they propose an ethical theory. Then they go and say, oh, you better go to Washington, D.C. You better show up for the op. If you're not there, you're not a good person. And that crap was going on in Seattle in the summer of 2020 on the other side, on the left-wing side. Oh, you better put on a black t-shirt and LARP up and down 12th Avenue during the worst pandemic in human history, even though 12th Avenue bisects major paths to every significant emergency room in Seattle. You see, there's a lot of things about the summer of 2020 in Seattle that don't fucking add up. Okay, you can get guilted into going to January 6th. You can get guilted into showing up and LARPing with BLM. And then you can stand outside a Chop Chaz half a mile because that's where the police cordon is in the rain and recognize that the reason why there's a police cordon, why they're tearing down, while they're tearing down Chaztopia, is they got to get rid of the evidence, probably to include some dead bodies. Yeah. There you go, Mr. and Mrs. Mega. And did you know Trump was still president at the time? I think an action should be righteous or neutral. There are lots of things that are kind of neutral. I don't think if you drink that you're harming anybody. That's a choice. If you're a parent, if you're responsible, if you have a job where you need to be sober, that's probably a very different issue. But if we're just talking abstractly, you go home from your job at night, you grab a beer and you drink. I think that that's a neutral thing. Morally, you could do it or not do it. It applies to skydiving. It applies to rock climbing. It applies to drag racing. It applies to a lot of things. It applies to UFC. If two adult males want to go into a ring and beat the crap out of each other, I think that's their fucking business. And if people want to pay for it, that's fine. However, that's not the same as dogfighting. Do you understand the difference? Like, I can respect a conscious being making a choice to do this. I cannot respect anybody that would torture a dog into getting into the ring. And how this connects to the trolley problem is a perspective thing. There are people who think the trolley problem is a reasonable thought experiment. I think it's torture. We're not the same. Next topic. Dan, what are you talking about? Just don't worry, shithead. So, anyways, this article I'm about to read comes from the Bangor. Bangor, that's Bangor, Maine. The Bangor Daily News. The headline is The Case for Fly Fishing in the Dead of Winter by Kevin McKay, Outdoors contributor. This was published on January the 2nd, 2025, Bo Blimp Doc. It was 4:30 a.m. on a winter day with a biting temperature of 22 degrees. The high would reach only 34 degrees. But the forecast promised no wind. A rare gift in winter. Oh, great. There's a paywall. Anyways, I just hit a paywall on this, so I'm not going to read any more of this crap. If you guys wanted me to, you can pay. Oh, here's something that might not have a paywall, but we'll see in a second. This is from the Born Star. Wow. I was going to go into the fly fishing and I should have checked the paywall, but I'll tell you something, folks. How pathetic is the world of journalism today? How broken is everything that you have to pay money to read an article about fly fishing in the winter? I guess the advertisers aren't paying. Hint, hint. This next article comes from the Bourne Star. That's Bourne, Texas. And headline: Savoring flavor, colon. Compadres avoring flavor. Compadres takes inaugural chili cook-off. This was written by Corey Smelker, a star contributor on January the 29th, 2025, Bull Blimp Doc. Savoring flavor, Compadres takes inaugural chili cook-off. Pure Country in Bourne was transformed into a battlefield of flavors Friday for the inaugural Bourne Champion FFA Chili Cook-Off competition. Chili lovers were packed into the event to see which local spot would claim the chili crown. Ashley Weldon, community fundraiser for Bourne Championships FFA, was an absolute beast when it came to advertising and marketing the event. She approached various restaurants for entries, convinced local businesses to donate some stellar items for raffles, and produced a seamless night that included a petting zoo, a mechanical bucking bull, and live music courtesy of Isaac Jacob Band of the Isaac Jacob Band. Kicking off the competition was Andrew Guzman from Bergheim, whose chili was a testament to Texas tradition. This is a smoked brisket and a venison brisket chili with no beans. True Texas chili, Guzman said. The chili, made from mule deer, was the result of a recipe perfected by Bergheim's owner, Alicia Gray, who has a history of winning food competitions. Next up, Stolt Smokehouse presented their famous brisket chili, which included beans, diverging from the beanless Texas tradition, but adding a personal touch. The chili's uniqueness was attributed to the use of beef tallow, enhancing the flavor profile. Chef Mark Sierra Wright accepts the championship belt won by Compadres Hill Country Cochina for its winning chili entry. With Sierra are his wife, Dahlia, and Isaac Jacob, recording star who performed at the event, sponsored by the Purple Heart Project. Okay. Star photo by Corey Smelker. 28 songs brought on, Star photo by Corey Smelker. 28 songs brought an unexpected twist with their turkey chili, developed by their manager, Josh Sotelo. I can't read more of this. It's not great writing, and it's not that interesting. I'm glad that people won the chili competition. I am doing my best with this, folks. Clearly, the fly fishing topic is broken. Next topic. Fly fishing is broken. My attempts at being mild, a milder consideration person, is just really broken. This next article comes from the Bitcoinist.com. Headline, the top meme coins expected to explode in 2025, and it's written by Bitcoinist in Crypto News 4 weeks ago, whatever. We anticipate 2025 to be a very good year for meme coins. After years of toiling in the shadows of its bigger siblings, Bitcoin and Ethereum, the top meme coins seem to be finally flexing their muscles. Crypto traders are preparing for Donald Trump's reascension to the White House on January 20th, partly by anticipating sudden gains in Bitcoin's value. When Bitcoin does well, other crypto coins usually also do well. If Bitcoin takes off like a rocket fuel as anticipated, then we can expect the following five meme coins to follow the same upward trajectory. Number one, Wall Street Pepe, or the Wepe. This project raised $42 million. Oh, wow, it nears listing. It's seeking to capitalize on the huge popularity of Pepe. Yeah, great, that's important. It has compelling use cases behind it. Beat the whales at their own game and hand the same financial insights and power to the hands of the little people. Wow, yeah. The next meme coin is called Slaxy. A layer 2 coin aims to improve Solana and raises $8.6 million. Slaxy pre-sale also started December 2024, blah, blah, blah. It's practical. However, practical real-world use is no guarantee of coin success. Whatever. The third meme coin, Flockers, vote to earn project attracts investors. Whatever. It promises token holders the right to vote on the coin's future. The fourth meme coin, Memex. Oh my god. Buying meme coins has always been a clumsy process. Holding Memex tokens gives you exclusive benefits. There's also the not so inconsiderable 1,260% staking APY and a token price of a penny, which gives you an early bird advantage, whatever. The fifth and I think last is just the Pepe coin. And yeah. Can meme coins help you get that yacht deposit in 2025? Well, you know, they didn't say yacht, did they? If you come back to me with, can it get you that yacht in 2025? Then I might be calling up Mr. Crypto and saying, how do I get the hooker too? With the expected Bitcoin surge after January 20th, your meme coin portfolio can look pretty respectable if the developers play their cards right. I can't read more of this. I'm trying so hard, brothers and sisters. It's like, I want to be bland and milquetoast and in the nuggety center. Not so much because I believe in it, but because there's nothing outside. There's nothing. If you look, in fact, this article itself points to the absurdity. What the fuck does the president of the United States have to do with the value of Bitcoin? If you had had this conversation in 2014 in Seattle, or rather 2013, so 12 years ago, right? And I did. I was at a meetup in Seattle with a lot of these quote-unquote smart people big into Bitcoin. And if you'd said to them, Bitcoin's value depends upon which president wins the election, they would have laughed at you. Not because they're good or smart people, but because they were promoting propaganda and their propaganda said, oh, it's decentralized, it's independent, it depends on no third parties, it's peer-to-peer, and so many other fucking lies. And they did turn out to be lies. It's not peer-to-peer, okay? It really isn't. People who think that crypto is peer-to-peer are deeply confused about what that concept is. Another thing is, it's not decentralized, it's polycentric. If you don't know the difference between polycentric and decentralized, then you're deeply confused. It is a grift. It's a wood chipper. I think it's a wood chipper too. It's not just a con. If there's enough time left in the game, they'll spin that story. But it was done on purpose. If you're going to print a shit ton of cash and you don't have a war going on, so you can't force people to buy bonds, the next best thing you can do is come up with a scheme to take that cash that you print and chop it up. And one of the ways it gets chopped up, other than the housing market, is with crypto. It goes in. It's like a Roach Motel. And I won't say a Roach Motel for value because fiat has no value. It's a Roach Motel for the quantitative easing nonsense, for the government-printed money. It's a Roach Motel for inflation. In fact, in some ways, you can think of, in fact, this might be the best way to think of crypto. You can think of crypto as a synthetic mechanism for deflation, which is to say that it really isn't deflationary as such, but because it chews up fiat, it acts kind of like deflation, kind of. Just like a bond that you can't, you know, dig into for 15 or 20 years, the money goes there. It might be accruing value, and you just have to believe that 15 or 20 years from now is a thing. Kind of like 8 years ago when I read about the Argentinians wanting to float a 50-year bond. It boggled my mind. I thought it was so absurd that I invented my 10,000-year galaxy bond, because why not? An adult who's probably going to invest is in their 20s or 30s, probably. Maybe their 30s. So that means if you invest in an Argentinian bond, maybe your grandchildren get it, right? And I have no idea if they're still doing that stupid nonsense. I don't really think Malay is what he appears to be. So it's hard to say. Me personally, when Malay, quote unquote, won the election, the first thought I had is, okay, the Fed is setting up a buyer. Just like they set up Belgium, you know, during the teens under Yellen. They were the buyer of last resort. It turns out our treasuries are selling well. Yeah, so Argentina's going to buy bonds for as long as it lasts, folks. I don't think there's that much time left. Next topic. Because I'm getting all whatever. This next article comes from Yahoo.com. Headline, adorable golden retriever puppy enjoys solo snow play in the most precious way. This is written by Nicole Pomerico, and it was published on January 8th, 2025, Bo Blimp Doc. Playing in the snow is a lot of fun at first. But if you have a dog or a kid, you probably have already learned that there simply isn't enough time to play outside as far as they're concerned. They could stand out there for hours. And meanwhile, the adult humans around are ready to pack it up and go inside and get drunk. And change into warm, dry clothes. It's very similar to trying to get a kid out of the pool. Neither my daughter nor my dog has ever met a temperature that was so cold they didn't want to play outside. It seems like the puppy in the TikTok video is probably going to be just like them. This golden retriever loves the snow so much that he's willing to play by himself in it. On Sunday, January the 5th, Belle and Murph, at Belle and Murph, shared this video of her golden retriever, puppy Murph. Murph hanging out alone on the porch as the snow was coming down. There was a light dusting on the porch since it was covered, but that was enough to make it so Murph didn't want to come inside. In the video, she said that her puppy had been out there like this for 20 minutes, and honestly, he does look perfectly content. Who needs a playmate when you've got snow? She also shared a video of Murph experiencing snow for the first time. It definitely seems like it was love at first sight for him. No wonder he doesn't want to come in. The answer to this question is going to vary depending upon what breed we're talking about. How long can dogs play in the snow? After all, there are some breeds like Huskies who are well suited to cold temperatures. And then there are other breeds like Frenchies and Scrongos and Dibliacs, including most small dogs and other types of rat cats. And you know, they got those fine coats and they're not useful for anything. They're going to get cold a lot faster. They're going to die sooner. According to what a veterinarian told the American Kennel Club, small dogs should only be out in the weather under 32 degrees Fahrenheit for 10 to 15 minutes at a time. Basically enough for the time for them to do their business. You know what I mean? These dogs can experience frostbite. They can experience hypothermia. They can go completely insane. They can do cocaine. So it's important that their little bodies don't get too cold. And as for medium to large breeds, they're usually good for about 30 minutes to an hour. While dogs who belong to Arctic breeds like Malamutes and Huskies can play outside to their heart's content if they're used to spending time in cold weather. And remember to warm everyone up once you come inside. A little snuggle by the fire never hurt anybody, okay? I think this was written as Los Angeles was burning. That's not funny. It's not funny, Dan. It's not funny. We could all snuggle by the fire. It's fine. It's all fine. It's gonna be fine. See, that was mild. Mild consideration. Next topic. this comes from the Iowa Press, Iowa City Press Citizen, and it was published on January the 6th, 2025. The author is Michael Nock, and the headline, food column, colon, New Year's bread. I don't often make New Year's resolutions. I disappoint myself in so many ways, and it seems silly to add more. Resolutions really do set us up for failure. According to a study by Forbes magazine, most New Year's resolutions last less than 4 months. Just 2% of us keep our resolutions for more than 7 months. Even fewer make it through the year. Last year, I fell somewhere in between. According to my journal, on January the 1st, 2024, I resolved to do the following: lose 15 pounds, start a blog or a Substack, finish writing a book for publication. Oh. Things started out great. I lost 8 pounds within the first 6 weeks. I also made good progress on 2 writing projects. By March, I was confident that this resolution business was easy. What is it that the Bible says about pride going before the fall? At year's end, I had gained 5 pounds, maybe more. And I was no closer to becoming a published author than I had been 365 days earlier. You may ask, am I depressed about this? Heck no. While I didn't keep those resolutions, I did manage to do a number of other things of which I'm proud. They include staying close to family and friends, continuing my historical research, and number 3, baking. Not a bad record, if I may say so myself. And now, here we are with yet another new year stretching out before us. It's another chance to try again with new resolutions for 2025. One good thing about failing to keep resolutions from 1 year is that they can be repeated in the next. Thus, I once again resolved to lose weight and to continue writing. I also intend to stick with one of my successes from the last year, baking. A regular reader of the column knows that baking is one of my favorite hobbies. From cookies to cakes to pies, especially pies. I love the challenge of throwing ingredients together, adding heat, and awaiting the delicious results. The one area where I sometimes struggle is bread. Bread is challenging. This is due to yeast. Which, you know, yeast, which can occasionally be temperamental. Sometimes it rises relatively quickly. Sometimes it does not. And how much rise is enough? How much is too much? Thus, instructions in a recipe can be nothing more than a guide. What I'm saying is that I need both more experience with bread baking and simple recipes to help me gain confidence. Enter no-knead bread. It doesn't get much easier than this, the ingredients of which there are few, are mixed together and then left to rise for a specified amount of time. Then they are baked, that's it. There are many recipes for no-knead bread, also called Dutch oven bread or Wyoming sideways action. This one is from a website, Give Me Some Oven. It's simple, though it does require an initial rising time of at least 12 hours and a hooker named Mabel. It also requires a Dutch oven, if you know what I mean, which is a large, heavy, lidded pot. And that pot can go from stovetop to oven. Thus, if like me, bread baking is one of your resolutions for 2025, give this easy recipe a try. If you do, you'll be able to cross at least one thing off your list for the new year. As I said above, this recipe from Give Me Some Oven Blah, blah, blah. Basically, it takes 12 hours for the first rise. That's because it only has a tiny amount of blah, 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 just a half a teaspoon of yeast, just like your ex-girlfriend. Ingredients, 3 1/4 cups of flour, 2 teaspoons of fine salt, 1/2 teaspoon of active dry yeast, if you know what I mean, 1 1/2 cups of warm water between 100 and 110 degrees, probably Fahrenheit, right? Stir together the flour, salt, and yeast in a large mixing bowl. Add the warm water. Transfer it to a garbage dump. Wait for a guy named Bob. He'll come by with a filthy old Hagen folk. She'll be carrying a flamethrower. Put this in a Dutch oven and bake it. Yeah, that's as good as I could do there. The next topic or article I'm going to read comes from the Business Insider. Headline, I tried every soup at Panera. Some really impressed me. But there are 21, excuse me, I thought that was 21. But there are 2 I'd never order again. This was written by Stephen John. That sounds like an AI name. And it was published on January the 16th, 2025, Boblimpdoc. With over 2,000 locations in the U.S. and Canada, Panera Bread is my go-to spot for a warm bowl of soup when I'm on the go. So I tried all of its year-round options to find the best ones. I skipped the seasonal menu items and the chili. That's like comparing apples to oranges, in my opinion. With the chain's broccoli cheddar, creamy tomato, home-style chicken noodle, cream of chicken and wild rice, bistro French onion, and rustic baked potato in front of me, along with a few sides of bread and chips, I got to tasting. Here's what I thought of each soup. The broccoli cheddar was rich, tasty, and comforting. I was unduly impressed with Panera's broccoli cheddar soup. It's an incredibly easy soup to screw up by adding too much salt, going overboard on the cheese, or messing up the consistency. My God. However, this version was rich but not overly thick, and it had a cheesy, creamy taste with just the right saltiness. The vegetables were cooked to an ideal softness, but weren't falling apart. My only complaint is that I would have liked a little more broccoli. Oh, but I'd still definitely order this again, especially when I need to warm up on a cold, rainy day. I absolutely love a good baked potato soup, and I tend to order it at restaurants when it's available. However, Panera's version did not hold up for me. The consistency felt far too thin and slightly overblended, which is meant an excess of release of starch from the potato cells. This led to a gluey texture, as can happen with mashed potatoes that are whipped too much. The soup also wasn't quite hot enough to melt the sprinkle of cheese on top, which didn't help. All in all, I thought the baked potato soup was a letdown. If you're a fan of tomato soup, I think you're insane. No, that's not what she said. If you're a fan of tomato soup, I think you're safe. Oh, good. To order Panera's creamy tomato. Wow. Ideally with extra croutons or chunks of bread to thicken it up some. Yeah. Okay. That sounds like a diabetes stew. I found the texture to be a bit too thin for a cream-based soup. Oh, boy. I bet you did, lady. But the flavor was excellent. It had the slightest bit of spice to round out the herby undertones. Although, I think I would have preferred it served in one of Panera's bread bowls for a healthier meal, it was still one of my favorites. I'd order it again. Oh. I enjoyed the cream of chicken and wild rice in the same way I might enjoy a piece of butter toast. It was good, satisfying even, but there wasn't really anything special about it. The consistency was good, and there were plenty of veggies and chunks of meat. However, the overall flavor was sort of bland and ambiguous salty creaminess. A little more spice would really elevate this soup. Uh-huh. French onion soup is another favorite of mine, but Panera's middling take on the classic disappointed me. The broth tasted too sweet for my liking, and the onions were cut a bit too thick. I also think they could have been cooked down more. Furthermore, Panera garnishes its soup with just a sprinkling of cheese and a side of croutons. A French onion soup without a layer of melty cheese slathering toast on top is like a football game with half the team missing because they're in my bedroom. This one is unfortunately a pass for me in the future. The next time I have a cold, I'm ordering Panera's home-style chicken noodle soup. The broth was rich in flavor, with a satisfying but not overpowering saltiness, and some umami notes. Oh boy, what really impressed me though was the volume of ingredients packed into the broth. There were lots of noodles, chunks of meat, pieces of sliced carrot and celery, broken glass and metal shavings. But I almost wish there was less, since the broth was so good and they had that diesel fuel flavor. Even sans any ailments, I'd order a cup of this again. The most humble of Panera's six soup offerings caught my attention the most. Every part of its chicken noodle soup tasted good. I'd also gladly order broccoli cheddar and creamy tomato again. The cream of chicken and wild rice needs a little more oomph, but it's still a contender. Even though, or perhaps because, they are usually some of my favorite varieties of soups, I wouldn't order the baked potato or the French onion at Panera again. They just didn't live up to my expectations. Okay. That was critical and not... I mean, who's going to get offended by soup? Who? Who's offended by soup? There are probably people that exist that get offended by soup. In fact, probably people who vote in general. People who get obsessed over Biden or Trump or Kamala, J.D. Trance, Tulsi et al. As if I give a fuck. You guys probably get pissed off about soup. But when you really think about it, soup is for slaves. I mean, soup, like beer, like barbecue, has its roots in control and slavery. You give the frothy brothy, you give the soup to the folks that live in the factory in Vietnam, you know. Frank's Fluids. Yeah. Here are the rudest countries ranked by me. And I used my own brain. I used no study, no data. I don't trust the internet. But I have ranked the rudest countries because I saw something that I needed to just do something with. Okay? The rudest country in the history of the world is Denmark. This is well known. Everybody knows this. The second rudest country is Bulgaria. In Bulgaria, they'll punch you in the stomach and they won't even give you $5. The third rudest is the USA. I'm not going to say more. I mean, come on. If you're dropping bombs on people, that's pretty fucking rude. The fourth rudest is Germany. Ha ha ha, we know why. The fifth rudest is Kazakhstan. Yeah, we also know why. The sixth rudest is Saudi Arabia, then Haiti, then Colombia, then Serbia, then France, then Cuba, then England, then Poland, then Somalia, then Chile, then China, then Japan, then Russia. But interestingly enough, at the bottom of the rudest countries in the world, number 19, is North Korea. And not because any of these countries is necessarily more or less rude than the other, but just because I really hate Denmark. And so on any list of shitty things, whatever follows might be open to speculation and debate, but the number one on the top of shitty things, any shitty topic, you know, worst people, most likely to murder puppies, it's always going to be Denmark. Always. It is Friday, January the 31st, the end of January 2025. We've made it through a whole month. And the sky's not falling yet. That's a really good sign. there's a lot of crazy shit happening and there's still a lot of smoke. In a weird way, all the smoke is kind of a good sign. Kinda. But not really. But who knows? All I know is the news is worthless. So if you're gonna, like, go to me for the news at this point, I'm probably gonna end up with broken paywall, you know, news articles about fly fishing because there's nothing else out there. There isn't. You can talk to me about your AI bullshit. I'm not interested. You can talk to me about your Ukraine war bullshit. I'm just not interested at this point. I don't really believe that Putin is an independent actor, so you can tell me how evil is. It doesn't matter. Our government, well before the Central Intelligence Agency ever existed, our government has been really good at setting up straw men to topple. So whether it's Manuel Noriega, Saddam Hussein, Adolf Hitler, Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh. You know, we supported Ho Chi Minh during World War II against the Japanese. We gave him copies of the Declaration of Independence, you know, that were in French and Vietnamese. And the problem with good old Ho Chi Minh is he took it seriously. Like, he actually believed our bullshit. That was his mistake. Our mistake was trusting the French. His mistake was trusting us. We set up straw people all the time. You know, we set up a Colonel Gaddafi so we can knock him over. Now we got some new dingbat in Syria. Who knows where this guy crawled out from, but we all know who probably runs the guy. And so if you're interested in stopping rudeness, if you're interested in putting an end to all that crap, the madness, then really a good place to just sort of uproot and toss into the ocean is CIA Langley. NSA, another good place. Federal Reserve, Eccles Building. These are all good places to protest and all good places to uproot. All of them. And if Donald Trump were actually a serious guy, and I don't think he really is, I think he's smoke, but if he were serious, he wouldn't drain the swamp. You can't drain a swamp. You don't build on swamps, you don't drain swamps. In fact, really good advice, you try to avoid swamps. There's nothing, zero, zip, nada, that I'm aware of in the Constitution that says the Capitol has to be in Washington, D.C. I'll look at it again. But I don't think there's any part of the Constitution that says the Capitol has to be Washington, D.C. The smartest fucking thing you could do if you were actually real, if he was a real guy and not just a giant fucking smoke grenade, the smartest fucking thing he could do to deal with the swamp is to move the Capitol. Yeah. You tell me, Mr. Mega Man, do you think he'll do that? Then he's in the swamp. And he's in the swamp. He's of the swamp. If you want to play pretend that he's not, play pretend. At this point, we all get to. Because the lawyer's coming. So play your Monopoly. Play your Atari. Watch a fucking movie. Watch E.T. It's out on VHS. Because the lawyer's coming. And until then, you can play pretend. You can play pretend that mommy and daddy stay together forever. You can play pretend that true love is real. And you can play pretend that the human race can consume 10,000 years worth of lunches in 100 years without any fucking consequences. Good luck playing pretend. I'm really good at it. Most of you are just not that good at it. But I'm pretty fucking great at it. Happy Friday.